This passage contains lots of incredible claims that Jesus made. And we're going to have a look at those today. And what I'll do is I'll go through them and then ask you to consider them. Last time I preached, I started this way by looking at the recent sermons that I preached. And here they were. Last autumn, I preached on a dispute between Jesus and the Jewish leaders about who Jesus was. We came to January, I think, and I preached from John chapter 7, verses 14, and that was about a dispute between Jesus and the Jewish leaders about who Jesus was. About a month ago, we started John chapter 8, and that was about a dispute between Jesus and the Jewish leaders about who Jesus was. I wonder if anybody can guess what this week's going to be about. Yeah, we're still in the same dispute between these Jewish leaders and Jesus about who Jesus was. And I said that really underlined John's desire to get across who is Jesus. That is the central theme about this gospel, about all the gospels. Who is Jesus? And there's a lot devoted to this subject. And we looked last time about this, and this here is the question that Jesus asked his disciples. And it's a question that John, in by extension, asks each one of us. What about you? Who do you say that I am? And Peter's reply was this: you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And that is the answer. That is who Jesus is. But it's a case of people realizing that and accepting that and taking that on board. We're going to look at four claims that Jesus made today. The first one was that God was seeking his glory. Now that might not seem too outlandish, but I'll come to that in a bit more detail. Jesus says, I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. A little later he says, my Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. We'll go more into that in a little while. The second one which I want to look at in this first half is this one, which again, when you look at it, seems really bold. Obey my word, never see death. Now that's quite a claim. Obey my word and never see death. Very truly I tell you, whoever obeys my word will never see death. That's in verse 51. But the passage starts with the claims of the Jews about Jesus, what they think about him. They say, you are a Samaritan. Now that has got a lot of depth and hatred behind it, that phrase. You are demon-possessed. And in words of meaning this, you are talking rubbish. Pretty well what they say by the time we get to the end of this passage. And this is one of the examples where they're saying it. You are not yet 50 years old, they said to him. And you have seen Abraham? You could almost taste the sarcasm in that, in their voices. So let's have a quick check on those three things. Firstly, you're a Samaritan. Now, historically, the Samaritans came about when the northern tribe of Israel was sent away and captured and taken into exile. The Samaritans came about when the people who replaced them, they intermarried, and their beliefs became distorted. And basically they were looked down on. They were hated. They were blamed for past sufferings from the Jews. And a Jew who lived down in Jerusalem, who wanted to go up to the northern part of Israel, would take a wide detour just to avoid going through the land of the Samaritans. You might be aware as well that Jesus also told a story about loving your neighbour. And the way he put it, the villains, the priest and the Levite who ignored the man in need and passed by on the other side, but the hero of the piece was a Samaritan, a person despised by these folk. And he was the one that took care of this, of the person that had befallen amongst thieves. So they knew that as well. "You're a Samaritan," they say. And then they had to explain away the gifts that Jesus had, the healings that Jesus did, the freeing of people from demon possession. They had to explain how Jesus could do that. They weren't prepared to acknowledge his divinity. They weren't prepared to acknowledge his specialness. What they'd said was basically, "You can throw demons out of people because you are demon possessed yourself." They credited what he did to the devil. They saw his power, they looked at it, and they discredited it, and they put it onto him doing it because Satan allowed him to do it. And they also saw that he was talking rubbish, they thought. When he claims to be greater than Abraham, they're looking at Jesus as only a human teacher. They do not believe any claim that they felt was not logical. Anything that he could do which was not easily explainable, they were prepared to attribute to other sources. And that was their claims about him. This discussion has been building up all through chapter 8 and is getting more and more heated. And by the end of this chapter, it is really at an exploding state. It comes to a great head. So let's look at these claims of Jesus. Two in the first half and then two in the second. God is seeking his glory. Now for a man to say that God is seeking my glory is a very blasphemous claim almost. Because this is what we read in the Old Testament. "I am the Lord, that is my name, I will not yield my glory to another, or my praise to idols. See, the former things have taken place, and the new things I declare before they spring into being, I announce them to you." God does not share his glory with others. He will not need to yield his glory to another. And this is way back in Exodus when the Ten Commandments were given, the first commandment basically. "Do not worship any other god, for the Lord whose name is Jealous is a jealous God." Now when we hear the word jealous, we tend to think of that as a vice. We tend to think of that of envy, of being jealous of other people's talents. But God is jealous for the worship that he is due. And his name is Jealous. And you might, that might be a name that you don't think God has, but it is. And that is actually Jehovah Kanna, Q-U-Q-A-N-N-A. Jealous of his own honour, one who will not see his glory given to another. This is God. There are many stories in the Old Testament which sort of show that, and one of the ones which came to my mind when I was looking this up was Gideon. Remember his story, what happened there. Israel had turned against God and were under the cosh of the Midianites at the time. They were making life generally a misery. And God seeks to find someone who will work with him to be able to free Israel from that. And as quite often he does, he picks the weakest clan and the weakest family and the least in the family. He doesn't go for the one who looks strong. He goes for the one who seems to the outsiders to be weak. This is what Gideon says. My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. And yet you come to me to help on this. Various discussions take place, various fleeces are laid, and eventually Gideon agrees to work with God in this respect. And they find an army. An army starts at 32,000 people. That seems like a decent sized army. Remember in the days when Ipswich had a great following, when we just about got 32,000 people in Portman Road, I think. So just think of a full Portman Road, and you'll have an idea of how many this army was. God takes one look at this army that Gideon found and says, too many. That's too many. If you feel that you're a bit afraid of this, if you're going into battle and you're feeling your knees knocking a bit, you're excused. So Gideon says that, okay. And 22,000 leave. We're down to 10,000. God takes another look at that. Too many again. And then he puts another test. And the test is this, that if you go down to the river to drink, how do you do it? Do you get right down and scoop water up and just lap it from the river? Or do you pick it up in your hands and take it here so you're still watching out to see what's coming? And only the ones that actually got the water, lapped it from in front of the face so they were still standing, were the ones that were picked. And there were 300 of those. So we've gone from 32,000, we now have an army of just 300. And those were the ones that God used, and those were the ones that God used to bring the victory. But why was that? And the answer was this. If I let you have more, all these thousands of soldiers, you will think Israel would boast against me. My own strength has saved me. They would think that they had won the battle from their own strength, when in fact God had won it for them, and the glory would go to the wrong place. God needed the people to trust him and him alone, not in their own strength. So God is seeking his glory, but there's a difference here. And the difference is this. Jesus is not just an ordinary man. Do you remember at the time when he was baptized by John? The Holy Spirit descended on him in bodily form like a dove, and a voice came from heaven and said this, you are my son, whom I love, with you I am well pleased. So God's son was Jesus. And that's why God was seeking his glory. And in return, Jesus was seeking his Father's glory as well. There won't be many months after this story what we're looking now at, when Jesus will be in the garden. And he will be praying. And he will say, I have brought you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do. So, as God seeks Jesus' glory, Jesus seeks his Father's glory. But still a claim to make that shows that Jesus is claiming to be God, not just a man. Our next claim is this. Obey my word, never see death. And that's quite a claim, isn't it? If you do what I say, you won't see death. And notice too, he doesn't just say, you know, I tell you, whoever obeys my word will never see death. Or I tell you that you won't see death if you obey my word. And he underlines it three times. He could have just said, I tell you. He could have just said, truly, I tell you. But he really underlined it by saying, very truly, I tell you. Whoever obeys my word will never see death. Underlining and stressing that, this is definitely something that he intends to say. And if you go forward two or three chapters, you will see this put into practice. When Jesus is talking to Martha, he has come in response to the need of her brother Lazarus, and Lazarus has now died. And he says to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. That same claim. Jesus, the resurrection and the life. But never see death? That seems quite a claim, doesn't it? When we look back, we have to consider that all of the disciples that Jesus had, all the people he's talking to at this point, would die physically. Within the first 100 years AD, they would probably all be dead. So does he mean physical death here, or what is he talking? Are we talking about spiritual death here? Look again at the words Jesus says to Martha. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. This is maybe talking about the resurrection of death. That's certainly the most obvious answer to that question. He's not talking about somebody living physically forever in respect of that, so they don't die. He's talking about the physically spiritual life, the life ahead, eternal life. Does Jesus mean the second death? What's the second death, you say? The final judgment. We hear about it in Revelation. The one who is victorious will not be hurt by the second death, the death of the judgment at the end of time. And it's certainly something that you want to avoid. We hear more about it a chapter or two later. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. Something you want to avoid, and something that following Jesus and putting trust in him means that we can avoid. So yes, if we obey him, we won't have to fear that. But look in the passage again. I just want to highlight the words see or taste. Will not see death or will not taste death. Because I think there's something there as well which gives us a little glimpse what he might be meaning. Paul talks about being absent from the body and present with the Lord. And that has a sort of instantaneous feel about it. This is the passage that we're talking about from 2 Corinthians. So we are always confident knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. We are confident, yet, well pleased, rather to be absent from the body and present with the Lord. So the change from being present with the body, but absent from the Lord in effect, to being absent from the body and present with the Lord. Is this something that happens immediately at the point of death? Is it something where we breathe our last breath and the next breath we're with Jesus? Clues, I wonder. Put yourself in a situation where you are dying on a cross. There are two people to your side who are dying as well. One of them is your partner in crime, and he's first away from you. But in the middle, there's a man called Jesus who's dying on the cross. It's labelled that he is the King of the Jews, and there's something incredibly different about him. In your agony, you call out to him. You say, Lord, you have done nothing wrong. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. You see him for who he is. And back come these words. Today, you will be with me in paradise. Not many years later, not at the end of time, today you will be with me in paradise. When you die, that's where you'll be. It's an incredible promise. So the question would be, will there be time to actually see or taste death? Maybe that's what he means. The hope that we have because we follow Jesus, because we put our trust in him, that we won't see or taste death, because as soon as we die, we will be with him. Two great claims about Jesus makes for himself. There are two more to come, and I'll come back with those in just a minute. The incredible claims of Jesus, the second part. Two more. Remember, the first half of the sermon we talked about, God is seeking the glory of Jesus. And we also talked about, obey my word and never see death. Two incredible claims that Jesus made, that only could make if he was the Son of God. Let's continue. Here are claims 3 and 4. The first one was that Jesus was older and greater than Abraham. I'll show you why that is quite an incredible claim. He says, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. That's an incredible claim. But then the one that really takes the biscuit, and the one which really riled these teachers and caused them to pick up rocks against Jesus, was this. Before Abraham was born, I am. Very truly I tell you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. The two claims are linked, but we'll look at them separately as we go. But let's start with this one, older and greater than Abraham. Why does he go on about that? Why does he pick on Abraham? Well, throughout this discussion, the Jews have been claiming Abraham as their father. They've been claiming that he really is the reason for their hope, their faith, their following. As sons of Abraham, they consider themselves right with God because of that. But Jesus is saying that he's greater than that. Now, after Jesus made that claim about not seeing death, if you do my words, you won't see death, they challenge him. Well, hold on. Abraham is our father, and he died. So what's this about not seeing death? They challenge him there. And he says this, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. What does he mean by that? Let's have a look at Abraham and see what we can work out. Did Abraham meet Jesus when he was alive? Well, there are two possibilities that he may well have done. One that comes from this story. This is back in Genesis 14. There's an occasion when there's been a battle between two sets of kings. And as a result of that, Abraham's nephew Lot has been captured with his family and taken away. Abraham gets together people that, from his household and connections and sends an army and captures them back, presumably with God's help. And then comes this king, a person called Melchizedek. Who was he? This is what the Bible says. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. You also learn that there was no mention of his father or mother or where he was born or when he died. And that's taken up later in the Bible. Look at that. A king of Salem, king of peace. A priest of God Most High. Normally, when you look back at priestly roles and kingly roles, they were separate. To be a priest, once we got to Moses' time, you had to be of the tribe of Levi. To be a king, you had to be of the tribe of Judah. Separate things. Jesus would qualify for being a king on a human basis, but not a priest under that. However, this person was both. And notice what he brought with him. Bread and wine. What does that remind you of? What haven't we been able to celebrate because of the limitations? Communion. And it is thought that Melchizedek, appearing here, may well have been a pre-incarnate visit of Jesus himself. We don't know for certain. But certainly when we get into Psalms and Hebrews, it says, "For it's declared, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek," talking about Jesus. Jesus, like Melchizedek, is both a king and a priest. So did Abraham meet him there? Was that Jesus he was talking to? He certainly paid him homage and reverence and gave him tithe as well. But if we go on in Genesis, we find a time when God visited him. This is what it says. Then the Lord appeared to him, that's to Abraham, by the terebinth tree at Mamre. That's where Abraham was staying. So when Abraham saw them, he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. He ran from his tent door to meet them and bowed himself on the ground. This is a time when Abraham and Sarah, well, in their latter years, Abraham was, I think, 100 and Sarah was 90. And the promise was this, that in 1 year you will have a child. And that came to pass. It was also at a time when the nation of Sodom, or the town of Sodom, was coming up for judgment. And God talks to Abraham about that. And Abraham, you remember, says, "Lord, if there's 50 people there who are righteous, will you spare the city for their sake?" We go down from 50 to 40 to 20 to 10. They leave it at the end. "Lord, if there's only just 10 people righteous in Sodom, please will you spare it?" And God says, "Yes, I will. But there aren't 10. Lot and his family are the only ones that are rescued." This is a time when we believe that Jesus met with Abraham as one of these people. The Lord appeared to him by that tree. So, yes, there was a time when Jesus did appear to him. Your father Abraham rejoiced in the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. I think one of the things, well, to me, which makes the most sense on this, is God's call to Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. It came out of the blue. Abraham is even older now. And he's thinking, why, Lord, would you want me to sacrifice my son? I've waited years and years and years and years for my son to be born. And you promised him to me. And now you're telling me to sacrifice him? He went. And on the way there, he was talking to Isaac. Isaac had noticed that they've got wood and they've got everything here. But he was thinking, there's something missing here. If we're going to sacrifice, what are we going to sacrifice? And he asked Abraham, oh, where's the sacrifice? And Abraham says this prophetically, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. I don't know if at this point he says, well, you're it, or quite what he's, the way he says it. But that's what he says to Isaac. He believes that he's going to come back with Isaac as well. He believes something's going to happen, that Isaac will not die at this point. But that's prophetic, because the place where he's taking Isaac is exactly the same place that Jesus died and was crucified. He's taken to the very mountain, the very hill where Jesus died. There would be a time when the Father would offer his Son on that hill for mankind. He would provide the lamb for the burnt offering. You probably know when Abraham and Isaac get to the top of the hill, Abraham prepares his son and gets ready to kill him, but is stopped by an angel, and a ram is provided there to make the sacrifice. But Abraham also appears in the New Testament as well. This is a time here where Jesus is in conversation again with the leaders. And he's in conversation with the Sadducees, who particularly don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And they're asking him, what happens if a woman marries her husband, the husband dies? And in those days, if the husband died, then the brother would step in and be the next husband. So husband two, he dies. Husband three, he dies. Husband four, he dies. I think if I'm husband five, I might be wondering what this woman's cooking's about. But husband five, six and seven also marry her, and they all die. And eventually the woman dies herself. They say, oh, Jesus, if there's a resurrection, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? There's seven of them. They all married her. Who gets her? And Jesus says, in heaven there's no marrying or giving in marriage, but there is a resurrection. And you know that from Scripture. The Bible says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. I am, notice. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Notice that word, I am, not I was the God of Abraham when he was alive and the God of Isaac when he was alive, but I still am the God of these folk. They are still alive. And he illustrates that even further with another parable that he told about a rich man and Lazarus. Not the Lazarus that he rose from the dead, but a different. This is a parable. And the rich man is well off and living the life of Riley and just getting with having a great time. Lazarus is just sitting at the gate begging. covered with sores and utterly ignored. And eventually they die, and the time comes when the beggar dies, and the angels carried him, where did they carry him? To Abraham's side. I wonder if Jesus picked that because he knew that these people he's talking to, they would be depending on Abraham. They would be expecting that. The rich man, however, is not so lucky. And there's a conversation between Abraham and the rich man about how he can be relieved of his suffering and the like. So, Abraham there is mentioned in heaven, shown there. Jesus, greater than and older than Abraham. But now we come to the clincher, the clinching claim. This is linked with the previous claim. Before Abraham was born, I am. And this, you can feel muscles tense at this point, because this claim is going to uncover everything. Now, just to give you an idea, it's estimated that Abraham lived between about 1996 BC to 1821 BC. Those who've worked out from all the dates mentioned in the Bible will work out that. So almost around 2,000 years prior to when Jesus is having this discussion, Abraham was alive. And yet he claims, before Abraham was born, I was. They come back by saying, well, hey, you're not 50 years old yet. They can see that he isn't 2,000 years old, as far as they can see. And you claim to have seen Abraham. That's their claim. And then we get that reply. Again, notice it. Jesus doesn't say, well, I tell you, before Abraham was born, I am. He says, doesn't say truly I tell you, he says very truly I tell you. Again, that three underline effect. Very truly I tell you, before Abraham was born, I am. But if you look at that sentence, it feels that the tense is all wrong. You would think that it ought to be, before Abraham was born, I was. I was there before Abraham. Not I am. So that just sounds present tense. Sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? But that's because Jesus is saying something even more outlandish than I am older than Abraham. Jesus' claim is much more than that. And you can see with their response to this claim how outlandish this claim is. It changes everything. Go back 1400 years. A man called Moses, who's a shepherd at this stage, comes across a bush. It's burning, but it's not being consumed. And behind that bush, the reason it's not being consumed is this is God. And God talks to him. God plans to send Moses to Egypt to arrange to work with him to relieve the people of Israel, to bring them out of suffering. And eventually he says to Moses, after a discussion about, you know, can I go? I'm not the right man. Moses asks him this question. Moses says to God, suppose I go to these Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, well, what's his name? What shall I tell them? And God says this. God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. I am. So when Jesus says I am, he is claiming to be the Son of God, even God himself. And that is why you get this incredible reaction to him. Jesus is using God's name. He is claiming to be the Son of God, even God himself. And at that, they pick up stones, and their aim at that moment is to kill him. This is blasphemy in their eyes. Jesus is claiming to be God. But Jesus hid himself away, slipping away from the temple grounds. How easy was that to do? Not very, I suspect. It may have required something supernatural to release himself from them. You see, as we heard earlier, his time had not yet come. It would come within 6 months or so. His time would come, and they would seize him, and they would arrange for him to be killed. But he would rise again from the dead. So what do we make of Jesus Christ and these claims? These are incredible claims. That God would seek the glory of this man, Jesus Christ. That if we obey his word, we should never see death. That he was older and greater than Abraham. And that before Abraham was born, I am. If this is a mere man making those claims, then he's either mad, if he doesn't know that they're wrong, or if he's making them deliberately, even though he does know they're wrong, he's bad. But he is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. That is the conclusion we claim. If he makes these genuinely, then he is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Do we believe him? After they killed him, as I said before, greatest evidence of all, he was raised from the dead. He came back to life. And that is where we put our faith and our hope.